I wake you? Startled, wasn't it? Okay, House Judiciary is in session, probably 1 o'clock, March 11th. We have Representative Lynn, Representative Keller, Representative Gruenberg, Vice Chair Representative Thompson, myself, Chair Gatto. Representative Holmes will not be joining us today because he was absent. Housekeeping, the famous cell phone trick. If your cell phone goes off, then you're arrested.
Already patted down.
So, first bill, we're going to hear, we'll deal with three bills today. House Bill 14, the first one, which is executive ethics, legal fees, and family travel. House Bill 127, if you're not familiar with which one that is, crimes involving minors, stalking. And if we get to it, House Bill 76, stalking, sexual assault, protective orders. So we'll begin with House Bill 14, executive ethics, legal fees, family travel. The sponsor is the famous Representative Max Gruenberg. And Gretchen Staft is going to join us at the table. And I'm sure she will give us the testimony. Do we have Judy Brockman and Dan Wayne online or available one way or another? So, Judy, are you available?
I'm here at the LIO in Anchorage.
Okay, your voice, somehow or other, your voice is about 100 yards away. We'll see if we can't get that increased. Okay, Gretchen, you're on.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Gretchen Staft. I am staff to Representative Max Gruenberg. House Bill 14 basically puts forth in statute the substance of the recently enacted Attorney General's regulations regarding, one, the payment of travel expenses for family members of the Lieutenant Governor and Governor, and also the payment of legal fees for executive branch employees who are accused of ethics violations. Both the bill and regulations would authorize the state to pay for the travel expenses of the spouse and child or children of the Lieutenant Governor and Governor in certain situations, and which I'll explain when I go through the sectional, and would also authorize the state to pay for legal expenses incurred when an executive branch employee is accused of an ethics violation and are then exonerated of that charge. Why we decided to put these forth in statute rather than just keep them in a regulation is that there is a question of whether these regulations were enacted outside of the scope of authority of the Attorney General. And whether or not that's true, the sponsor also thought that there could be an appearance of impropriety, basically because the executive branch was creating regulations that would specifically benefit the executive branch. So just by putting these forward in statute by another governmental body, I think we can eliminate that appearance of impropriety. Like I said, these are mostly the same as the governor's regulations, the attorney general's regulations, with two minor differences. And I will explain those more in detail when we go through, but just to give you a heads up, the first difference is in the family travel section. The regulations only authorized the state to pay travel for minor children, meaning children 18 or under, or under 18, for the of the Lieutenant Governor and Governor. We, on the other hand, would allow payment of expenses for minor children, and if there's an older child who is disabled or otherwise dependent on the Governor or Lieutenant Governor for their daily care, then we would authorize travel expenses in the same limited circumstances as we would for minor children. And the second difference between our bill and the regulations is that the regulations would allow for payment of legal fees while the case is ongoing. If an executive branch employee is accused of an ethics complaint, the regulations would authorize the state to pay their ongoing legal expenses in advance of exoneration On the other hand, in our bill, the sponsor thought it was a better policy decision and safer for the state to wait till the person has been exonerated and then at that point authorize the reimbursement of the legal fees.
Sure, because if the person was on their way to jail, that would not have, we would not have wanted to have paid their legal fees for them.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, with your permission, I will go ahead and just do a brief sectional of the bill. Section 1 of the bill basically just eliminates the definition of partisan political purposes, and we end up moving that to Section 3 of the bill, which just puts it at the bottom of the statute, and just it doesn't change the substance of the definition at all. It just changes where it's placed, and then there's a minor stylistic change for a partisan political purpose on page 2, line 10 of the bill. Section 2 has the same stylistic change on page 2, line 25. Partisan political purposes is changed to a partisan political purpose. Section 3 is where we start to get to the meat of the bill. This is the section that authorizes the use of state resources to pay for the spouse and child of the governor and lieutenant governor to travel in certain circumstances. The use of state resources is only allowed if there is no partisan political purpose for the travel and if the event meets certain criteria, which is enumerated below. Basically, the event has to be a benefit to the state.
Is there any event that doesn't have the tiniest political purpose embedded?
Well, I would say, Mr. Chairman, if you look at the definition of partisan political purpose on the bottom of page 3 onto page 4, the event in its entirety, or at least a significant part of the event, has to be intended to benefit a candidate or a political party or group. If there is, and if you look at page 4, lines 3 and 4, you can see if the event is intended to benefit the public interest at large and it's within the normal duties of the governor or lieutenant governor, then that would be okay. Then payment would be authorized for that. But I would say a smidgen. I don't know.
We don't know how big that is, so yeah. It's a big hole in the wall here.
Well, I think under the facts, and we can ask Judy Bachman if that's something that they think would be a problem to distinguish. But I don't think it has been in the past. I think it's pretty clear if they're going to a Democratic event or a Republican event or a fundraiser for a candidate, I think that would be pretty clear.
Well, let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. You have a special needs child. Maybe you have two or three. And normally we would travel in commercial, but you now have to charter your personal jet to do the same travel. Then we're going to pay for the personal jet.
Right, but it depends on the circumstance. If they have to repay the state, or?
Well, the bill authorizes children to accompany the legislator, administrator, or governor, or whoever. And if the children are unusual in that they can't travel in the seat next to the administrator, but require a nurse, an oxygen bottle, somebody to aspirate, all those things, they're going to have to travel differently. And differently usually means charter. The question I have is, would the state then pay? But, and I'm thinking the answer is yes, because they're allowed to travel and this is the only way they can travel. Then the state would have to pay the bill for extraordinary charges for allowing the children to accompany them.
Mr. Chairman, in certain circumstances, yes, you're correct. In order for the state to pay the travel expenses for that disabled child, though, and to not require reimbursement, the event that the child was traveling to would still have to meet all the criteria enumerated in Section 2 of the bill, which is Section 2 of Section 3, which is page 3, lines 15 through 29. So if the child was attending, say, for example, as an officially designated representative of the state or one of the other criteria enumerated, then yes, then the state would have to pay, even if it was a charter flight. But I would also point out that that's going to happen in very limited circumstances, that we're not going to run into that situation very much in the state.
And if we do run into it, even though you're stating we won't, you'll pick up those extra charges?
Mr. Chairman, yes. We thought the sponsor thought that it was fair to pay for these expenses for disabled children as well as minor children.
Representative Gruenberg?
Thank you. Just to follow up on yours. the regulations currently do exactly that. The only difference with the bill itself is that we added for like developmentally disabled kids mm-hmm. or something like that, because we just had a governor who had mm-hmm. a little baby. Mm-hmm. And if a child requires oxygen, that sort of thing, or an adult, unlikely they'd be traveling around the country. I mean, that you don't just take a kid who's in that fragile situation. I don't think parents would generally do that. I think the feeling of the Attorney General when they drafted the regulation, certainly my feeling when I sponsored the bill, is particularly if you have a little child or a child who's developmentally disabled and really dependent upon the parents, it puts the parents and these are on official state business, puts them in a very difficult situation. Either they can't attend or the child separated from the parent. Just from a humane point of view, I would hope that the committee would agree that that's something we
unless somebody wants to speak to that point, I think the committee does agree.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, if I may continue, we can move on to Section 4 of the bill, which regards legal fees, the payment of legal fees and costs when an executive branch employee is accused of an ethics violation. Under this section, which is already, I'll add, is already mostly in regulation and already law, if an executive employee is accused of a violation under the Executive Ethics Act, they can be reimbursed for their legal fees and costs in defending against that complaint if they are exonerated. And as I mentioned before, our bill would require the state to withhold payment until the person has been exonerated, and then they can be reimbursed their entire costs. The regulations allow for the ongoing payment, and then the state would be put in the position of trying to run and try and catch that person and recover their costs if the person is ultimately found to have violated the Executive Ethics Act.
I jumped page 4, line 7. Mm-hmm. Third word, may,
yes.
May pay. So we have no obligation, but I wanted to continue past that. Pay the fees and costs of private legal representation. Would that allow a person to have four attorneys? Four private attorneys to represent them?
Well, Mr. Chairman, certainly a person could choose to do that, but the state would not pay for four different attorneys. I'll turn your attention to page 4, lines 30 through page 5, line 3, which requires that the fees and costs of private legal representation be reasonable and necessarily incurred. And so when a court is looking at the reasonableness and necessity of the fees and costs, they'll look at all kinds of different factors, which it, and I'll note that in Civil Rule 82, they note a lot of the factors that they look at. If the amount of hours charged were reasonable, if for the claim they probably didn't need four attorneys, so I don't think that they would authorize that.
I think you have it. It's there.
Yeah. And under this section also, if the person is accused of multiple violations, if they are exonerated for anything less than all of the complaints, then the payment would be apportioned by violation, and they would be reimbursed only for the charges that they were exonerated of. And that is the gist of the bill. If you have any questions, I would be more than happy to answer them.
Why are
we, Representative Keller?
In Section 4, the approach here is to that the person or whoever the elected person is, they have to pay and then they are reimbursed, right? Did you approach this thinking maybe there's a possibility of allowing the state to pay and then if they're found in violation, they have to reimburse? And did you go that route instead?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, yes, that is something that the sponsor considered. That's exactly how it is in regulation right now. So we certainly considered that. We just thought that it was much safer for the state to protect its resources by not issuing payment until exoneration was certain. And we have never authorized, the state has never authorized the reimbursement or payment of legal fees at all until this, with the exception of, I think, the judicial branch does something, but they require that the person be exonerated first as well, and then they reimburse the person accused. We had the legal research, legislative research department, look and see if they could find any other laws in any other jurisdictions that allowed for ongoing payment of legal fees in advance of exoneration. They didn't find anything within the time frame that we gave them to do the report. They couldn't find anything. So the regulations which in Alaska which allow for the ongoing payment are the only ones that they could find that did that. All the other states would reimburse after exoneration. It's really a policy call, but we felt that it was safest to the state, especially because until these regulations were enacted in December, people couldn't get their legal fees at all. And in the legislative branch, if somebody is accused of an ethics violation, we can't get reimbursed for our legal fees. So we just thought this was a big step forward, giving legal fees in the first place. We thought that was fair to do, but that it's just safer for the state to wait till someone's exonerated.
Follow up.
I would like the committee to consider, going the other route on this. We're authorizing the state agency to pay. Why couldn't we authorize them to contract for legal services and then reimburse based on receipt, some kind of a standardized receipt so that there's good accounting as we go, so we know exactly what's being paid for, and then, very carefully spell out that if a person is found to be in violation after all, then they have to pay it back. Just for consideration, I'd like to do it.
Okay. Representative Gruenberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that point, the normal practice in civil litigation under Rule 82 and Rule 79 is that the case has to be finally disposed of. A final appealable judgment has to be entered. And there's usually a decision or a jury verdict, and then there's a judgment form prepared. And there's a blank for costs and a blank for attorney's fees. Like, let's say you sue me because you've sold me your car and I didn't pay you the $1,000. be a judgment for Wes Keller against Max Grunberg for $1,000 plus interest from the date that was awarded, that was due, plus costs of blank dollars, plus attorney's fees of blank dollars. Under Rule 79, then you would submit your cost bill, it's called a cost bill, to the clerk of the court. And the rule's very specific as to what are allowable cost filing fees and stuff like that. And they would fill it in, and you can appeal if you disagree with the amount. And attorney's fees are then filled in by the court. You do a motion afterwards, and you get it. And the total judgment is totaled, and at that point, you can get the writ of execution. So it's done at the close of the case. The way the regulations have it, I think is a very dangerous practice, because people can get their fees and costs in advance of the conclusion of the case. And in one sense, that's fair. It helps the person pay the costs. However, if the person's not exonerated, and let's say they've been embezzling or something, the person can skip the jurisdiction, and then not only do you have to get the money back, the state, but they have to try to find the person. And the costs go up. It's very problematic, and I can speak as an attorney who's had to chase clients and try to get legal fees after the close of the case when their retainer has been exhausted. It's the same kind of thing, and a lot of times the people are judgment-proof, particularly if they've been engaged in questionable activity and that kind of a thing, or they could take a bankruptcy or whatever. It's just, I don't think, as good a business practice. Good. And just so you know,
summarize.
That the courts, we have a legal memorandum dated the 25th of January from Patricia Young, Ledge Research. The court system does allow in advance, under a contract, judges to get their fees and stuff, but that's really a different view. This section of the bill, Section 4, is not just for governor and lieutenant governor or cabinet officers. It applies to any member of the executive branch, even somebody who's a cafeteria worker or a bus driver or whatever, anybody who's accused of an ethical violation. So there are thousands of people who are potentially affected by this.
Just one quick follow-up clarification, if I could, Mr. Chair, and that is that, again, I just will ask for consideration of this because it seems far less risky to me for the agency to be able to go into it with their eyes open and pick their counsel rather than committing to something they don't know what they're committing to, and then, where there's legal costs that they, the cost could be more controllable, as it seems to me, and I would like consideration of that is all I'm saying.
Do you want to answer that?
Yes, through the chair, thank you, Representative Keller. I just want to clarify that in this situation, the state couldn't pick who is defending the employee against their claim because it's the state bringing the charges. It would be a conflict of interest for them to handpick somebody to represent them. So I think it would be the employee's choice who's accused to choose their.
Oh, of course. I didn't mean to imply that, but what? Once it's picked, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Can I see the chair?
Yeah.
To Gretchen. Once the council is picked, to be able to contract and lay out what's happening. Usually there's some planning management on the process.
Just for the record, we were joined by Representative Pruitt some time ago, and I guess we got involved in conversation. Did you want to speak?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Has there been any consideration of potentially adding into this the and I'll try to formulate thoughts and then and let you speak to it, where someone that brings a complaint against the executive branch, where that complaint is sealed for a period of time so that someone cannot use it as a press to get on the news or to get some publicity out of it. I think that's potentially, that goes into, I think, a cost savings potential for us if there's a lot of those and the states just start paying and it might discourage people from potentially bringing those forward, potentially flagrant ones if we thought about doing something like that. I don't know if there's been any thought, though, to do that.
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, no, as far as I know, that wasn't something that was contemplated in this bill in particular. I believe I'm more familiar in practice with the Executive Act governing the legislature than I am the executive branch, and Judy Bachman is on the line and can comment on this to a further extent. She's from the Department of Law. But I believe it's the practice in the legislature, at least, and so I don't know if it would be the practice in the executive branch as well, that there's required confidentiality when somebody brings a complaint. If they go out and tell the world that they filed this complaint, I think that that might squash it. But I'll defer to Judy Bachman on that point to see if that is, in fact, the practice. If they dismiss complaints once they're publicized, or how that works. But no, that was not something that was specifically considered for the purposes of this bill.
Just to follow up, or actually if Judy might be able to answer.
Judy Bachman, you want to jump on the microphone and we'll do a sound check quickly?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, it's still kind of weak, but you probably heard what we were talking about. We can raise the volume at this end. Did you want to make any comments about this particular issue?
I can just briefly say that the Ethics Act at this point does...
Yeah, hold on. Judy, hold on. Our ability to hear you is too diminished, and we need to work on that for a second here. It's probably not your end.
Is she trying to speak on a speakerphone?
Is she on a speakerphone?
Are you on a speakerphone, Judy?
No, I'm in your LIO office.
The moderator should be able to...
Try one more time.
I'm sitting in the big conference room at the LIO.
Okay, that's going to work for us. So go ahead and make some comments if you would.
All right. The Ethics Act currently provides confidentiality for a complaint and all materials collected in the investigation. Upon filing, it's the department's policy, as mandated by the statute, to keep the matter confidential. We don't comment even on the filing existence or status of any investigation. The situation we've seen, however, is that some complainants, sometimes before they file the complaint, sometimes in conjunction with filing complaints, have spoken out about it. Can you still hear me?
Yeah, we can still hear you.
Okay.
It's a struggle, but we're working on it.
Anyway, the Ethics Act currently does not provide any penalty for a complainant speaking out. And in our research and analysis of that issue a number of years ago now, we concluded that there are serious First Amendment issues, constitutionality issues with imposing penalties for persons, complainants who do speak out because of the preference to let citizens express concern and complaints about their government. So there is confidentiality. We do protect it in the process of the investigation, but there is no penalty when a complainant does what we've seen some have done.
Okay, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That obviously answered. So.
Good. Representative Gruenberg, by the way, I'm kind of trying to move this bill out shortly.
I just would like to make one or two sentences in response to Representative Keller. I think that what's really important to make sure that we have cost control, I think that's what you were getting at. Was it not to make sure? Yeah. Okay. If you look at page 4, lines 30 and following, Ms. Staff, who I think did a great job, thank you, said, these are language, this is very similar to Rule 82, and the personnel board who would be hearing the case and be deciding the issue of costs and fees, would make sure that the number of hours were reasonable and that the hourly rate was reasonable. And this is very similar to what a court does in Rule 82, and if the state that was prosecuting the ethics complaint felt that these were unreasonable, they would oppose the motion or partially oppose it, and then they would cut it down appropriately. We did that very carefully to make certain that the cost controls were in, and I want that really clear on the record.
Okay. No more questions from the committee. Anyone open it up to public testimony? Is there anyone in the room that wants to testify? Seeing and hearing none, is anyone online that wants to testify? Having no response, close public testimony. Brings us back to the committee. Committee members, anything we needed to add before we bring this bill up for a vote? Representative Keller?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for keeping Gretchen here. Just a few things I want to clarify in my mind. When we move the definition, does that change anything? I mean, by moving it out of a subparagraph and put it into a paragraph. So does that broaden or restrict the application? I cannot tell that. Maybe you know.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, no, I do not believe that it changes anything. It just it's still referring to the definition of partisan political purposes in that section, in that statute, but I don't think that it would have any substantive change at all. And we closed testimony. I was going to say, Dan Wayne, the legal drafter, was online as well. But it's my understanding that no, it would have no substantive change.
Okay. I'm satisfied. Could I ask another question?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 2, line 27. I know you're not changing this. This is as it is. This is existing language, as I understand it. Can't resist the opportunity to maximize a bill. Is there? Do you know if there's any cases out there? The 10%. Why 10%? Is that a good number? Why not 33%? Why not? It kind of seems to me like kind of a difficult, poorly defined, thing. And I just was wondering if there's history there, case law, or anything.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, I'm not aware of the history. This statute was drafted much before my time in the legislature, perhaps Representative Gruenberg can comment on it, since he's been around much longer than I have.
Can we get this bill out?
Yes. I think that was a figure that was put on years ago. If you really want to explore it, Ms. Bachman, who's the attorney that handles this in the AG and is very knowledgeable, can answer your question. I don't want to delay the bill, but if you want an answer, she's the person.
It probably was valuable to put a number in there rather than have it unnumbered as far as...
Yeah.
I mean, we could always change the number to 17 and a half if we wanted to. Anyone else have a question?
One last.
Representative Keller with the third last question.
Thank you so much. I would like to offer a conceptual amendment, just a small item, I hope. On page 3, line 26, where it talks about the event is a family or youth event. As I read that, I thought, I wonder what that means, and I was wondering if including the word oriented might clarify if the event is a family or youth-oriented event or a family-oriented event.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
I would consider that a friendly amendment.
Okay. We have a conceptual amendment adding the word oriented following
family.
Following the word family.
I thought you were family or youth oriented.
Or youth.
All right. So, correction. Following the word youth, in between the words youth and event, add the word oriented. Could we trouble you, Susan? You're so super. Okay. Any objections to the conceptual amendment? Seeing and hearing none, the amendment is adopted. Brings us back to the original bill.
Vice Chair Thompson, would you like to make a motion?
Thank you, Chairman Gatto. I move that House Bill 14 with conceptual amendment, version A, with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations be moved from committee.
Is there an...
Yes.
Okay.
There was no...
No.
There wasn't a C, yes.
No, the motion's correct as it is.
All right.
With conceptual amendment, I said.
Right. Is there an objection? Seeing and hearing none, the bill moves from committee. We're going to take 2 minutes. Committee substitute for House Bill 127, crimes involving minors, stalking, information, etc. The sponsor is by request of the governor. We already have a CS that's been adopted, and that brings us to amendments. Representative Lynn, did you want to offer amendment M.1?
I believe, Mr. Chair, the amendment's already been offered, and basically, I think this amendment has great potential for benefit, but really no harm. And I don't think we need to discuss this anymore. I'd like to move to... I don't want to delay the underlying bill, which I strongly support, and I just appreciate the up or down vote.
Representative Grunberg?
Mr. Chair, I think we have a new CS that we haven't yet adopted.
A new CS?
Yes. Yes. How about the one time we had it? Oh, it's an amendment.
It's an amendment, right.
Oh, I see. All right.
So there we go. We're back along the line we were traveling on. Amendment M.1, Representative Lynn, I think we've spoken to it in the past. The amendment is before us. Is there an objection to Amendment M.1 from Representative Lynn?
Mr. Chair.
I will give you most of a minute if you want to make the objection.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
We have debated this, mm-hmm. and the question really is whether this provision belongs in this particular bill, because we're getting into the question of whether criminal impersonation and a sex crime should be put into the statutes dealing with property crimes.
Okay. Ms. Carpinetti, would you step forward, please? I'm not even going to tell you to put yourself on the record.
You're generally on the record.
You probably have a card, insert card.
Okay.
Did you want to comment on M.1 by any chance? Because the question was placement, not the amendment itself.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity. We have expressed our reservations about this amendment. We were pleased when we heard that Doug Gardner had concluded that the false caller ID was covered under the current statute, now criminal impersonation, but we think under the circumstances the law is in pretty good shape with that consideration, and we don't think this is necessary. Okay. And it may lead to
conflict
toward results, especially considering the definition of sex offense. That's our position. But
and Representative Lynn, with that information that it's already covered in other places, am I correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, but we had talked to the Department of Law, and we had another amendment ready to go that would have changed the position of this, take it out of property, and we had talked to the Department of Law about that, and they said they still didn't like it, as I understand it. So we said, in the interest of trying to move the underlying bill along, we just go with where it is, since they didn't care. We were going to take it out of that second period in a more... perhaps a more appropriate section, decided not to do it. So after talking to the Department of Law, we said we just leave it where it is. We go up or down vote and
okay, then
move on.
We'll have to, I'll object to the amendment, and so we'll have to have a vote. We're ready for the vote? Susan? Amendment M.1.
Is that labeled number one for today?
Yes.
Yeah.
Different number than conceptual.
Representative Keller?
No.
Representative Pruitt?
No.
Representative Thompson?
No. Representative Bloomberg.
No.
Representative Holmes is not present. Representative Lynn.
Yes.
Representative Gatto.
No.
One yes. Five no.
So by a vote of 1-5, amendment number 1 is not adopted, which brings us now to, I'm going to say M3, but we'll call it amendment number 2.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, if we label it amendment, it's labeled M.3, but could we call it amendment 4 because of what occurred?
Sure. So I will do that. M.3 is now referred to as amendment number 4.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Representative Bloomberg.
Since my staff and I drafted this, actually my staff, I'm not going to get any of the credit. Gretchen did it.
Well, she's sitting outside range of the microphone. You could take all the credit.
It's all mine.
I'll offer it so we get it on the table, and I would defer to Ms. Staff to explain it.
Okay. So, you want to move it? Move amendment number 4?
Yeah, if somebody will object.
Is there an objection?
Object.
There is an objection. And so we'll hear from Gretchen Staff to address the question of what the amendment does and does not do.
For the record, my name is Gretchen Staff. I am staff to Representative Max Gruenberg. Good to see you all again. This amendment would, under Section 7 of the CS for House Bill 127, it would remove the provision that makes it a violation to distribute an explicit image of a minor to one or two people. This is because it came to our attention that under the second degree.
I don't know that the members have found it. It's a two-page deal, and it's got a memo from me on top, and this is what the second one is. I think members need to see what we're talking about, because the memo describes what it does, too.
And we are on page 4 of the CS.
Page 4?
Page 4 of the CS.
I think maybe we need to give them a copy of this. If we can scan it.
You want to take an edit?
Yeah.
Let's go off the record momentarily. M.3, which we have labeled, I already forgot, Amendment 4?
Yes, sir.
Amendment number 4. And Representative Gruenberg, did you want to defend the amendment?
To Ms. Staff, I'm going to get it.
Okay.
Representative Keller doesn't have this either.
I got it. He just gave me his.
All right, oh, fine.
Okay, here. Somebody else. Oh, got it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry. Thank you.
Okay.
If I may continue, Mr. Chairman.
Hold on a second.
Sure.
We seem to be organized, so we're back to amendment number 4 for committee substitute for House Bill 127, draft version M, so that it's clear to everyone. And now we have Gretchen Staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to clarify, we're looking at page 4 of the CS version M, lines 1 through 6, which sets out the penalties for sending an explicit image of a minor. This amendment would remove violation from the picture. This is because we realize that this would actually make it a lesser crime to distribute an explicit image of a minor than it would be to distribute an explicit image of an adult under the second degree harassment statute. And under that statute, it's a Class B misdemeanor to distribute with an intent to harass or annoy an explicit picture of an adult. So we just felt that it was inappropriate to make it a violation for distributing basically a naked picture of a child when there's a much higher penalty for distributing the same type of picture for an adult. So what we did with this amendment, we took out the violation and we moved the crime of sending an explicit image of a minor up to a Class B misdemeanor if the person distributes the image to, quote, another person. So we take out the consideration of 1, 2, 3, 4 people and just say if you distribute it to another person, it's a Class B misdemeanor. But if you distribute it to a website that's accessible to the public, if anybody in the world can click and see this picture, then it's a Class A misdemeanor. So we thought that was significantly more serious, and we thought that that was appropriate to leave that provision as is.
I can see that. Representative Pruitt?
I think from the first CS, or from the first to the CS, we changed it from a Class C felony to the Class A misdemeanor, correct?
Correct. I believe that's correct, yes.
And just for my humor, obviously I've not been able to be at all the working groups. Can we explain why we decided to do that, specifically as it relates to the...
The go from felony to a misdemeanor?
Yeah, especially when you're talking about putting something on the Internet that could potentially be there for a long time, damage someone's reputation or whatnot. If you'd
please. Maybe Ms. Carpinetti would like to come up as member of the working group, too. She was very involved.
A lot of workers in this group, huh?
Yeah, Jane was here, and I know you had your aide here.
Yeah, and Jen was there.
And Sarah, everybody, really, Jane. It was a very good group.
Do we have an overtime bill, or?
That's a good idea.
That could be another bill altogether.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pruitt, there was a group of about 7 or 8 people who are staffed to various members of the committee who decided that at least at this point it would be best to make it a Class A misdemeanor and not to make a felony offense at this point. I mean, I assume at some point if it becomes more serious an offense, the legislature could reconsider it. But I guess the consensus was for an act that at this point is not a crime, to make it a Class C felony would be a pretty major change in the law.
That's a pretty wide chasm between a high misdemeanor and a low felony. Is that what you're saying?
Well, between no offense at all and a C felony is especially a big jump. Okay.
Satisfied, everyone?
Thank you.
At least right up to where we are. So, get back to where I belong here. Like having an encyclopedia. We're on amendment number 4.
Okay. I wonder if our objections maintained.
I'll remove the objection.
Okay. Tony Newman, do you want to come forward and comment on this?
Hello, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tony Newman. I'm a program officer with the Department of Health and Social Services Division of Juvenile Justice. I sent a letter to the committee just to explain the distinction between a management of an offense as a violation and as a misdemeanor as far as the juvenile justice system is concerned. And just to clarify that when an offense is a violation committed by a minor, it is not managed in the juvenile justice system. A violation is managed through district courts. So keeping the offense is a misdemeanor means it remains managed by the juvenile justice system. I thought that was important to clarify for you.
Okay. I think that's excellent. Thank you for that testimony. I think that fits what we'd like to see. So we still, thank you. We still have amendment number 4 before us. Who had the objection?
I'll remove the objection.
Pruitt removes his objection. Is there another objection? Seeing and hearing none, amendment number 4 is adopted. And now we go to, that was M3, so we go to M.
M5.
There's an M4 also.
M.4 will now be called 5.
Correct. M.4 is now amendment number 5. So what you're looking at is M.4. If you have M.4, label it amendment number 5.
Yeah. You know. Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
I think probably as the chair of the subcommittee, I'll offer these so we get it on the record.
Okay. So
I will offer amendment number 5, and if somebody would object, I'll explain.
I'll object for discussion. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like Ms. Carpinetti, if through the chair, if that's okay, to come up. This is really done at the request of the Department of Law,
And, Mr. Chair, may we ask Ms. Carpinetti to explain this?
Please. Ms. Carpinetti, you're on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. We requested that the provisions that were put into the committee substitute regarding adoption of regulations be removed. After looking at various other administrative subpoena statutory provisions in our laws, we didn't find any that addressed or provided for regulations to be adopted. So instead of that, we just suggested the addition that service may be made by any manner authorized by law or acceptable to the Internet service provider, which is in lines 5 and 6 of the amendment. There's one. Okay. That was the reason for the amendment in the first place, so that what we need to do in terms of the amendment is to take out reference to the regulations and add the provision addressing service on page 9, line 24, and then on page 9, line 26, at the working group it was decided that setting aside should be removed, and quashing, which is a more common term that we use when we're talking about subpoenas. It's the same idea, right. The common term is quashing a subpoena. And then on page 10, lines 12 and 13, removing the allusion or the description of the regulations and adding the following provision that Attorney General's designee must be in the Department of Law. In the working group, there was some concern that it didn't say who could be the designee, which it doesn't, but the concern was to make it clear that the designee ought to be in the Department of Law and not another another person or place from another agency. So that was thought to be a good idea, and we have no objection to that. It seems like a reasonable thing to do.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
This is technically, Mr. Chair, an omnibus amendment. We did not do a new CS, but we brought these forward in the interest of time. And it's certainly divisible, but I would offer this as an omnibus amendment.
I want to describe what the difference is between Amendment Number 5 and Omnibus Amendment Number 5.
Yeah, this is more of a motor coach than an omnibus.
Yeah, so because it's not a single subject, it's we'll call it an omnibus amendment, and if somebody objects to it, we'll have to pass it one piece at a time, or at least address it one piece at a time. So Omnibus Amendment Number 5 is before us. Is there an objection?
You need to remove your objection.
Thank you. I'll remove my objection. That would take care of the discussion phase. Any other objections to Amendment Number 5? Seeing and hearing none, Amendment Number 5 is adopted. Takes us to Amendment Number 6, labeled M.5.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
I will offer Amendment Number 6, which has been labeled in the upper right, M.5, that'll be amendment number 6, and I will offer it on behalf of the subcommittee.
Okay. Is there an objection? Representative Pruitt, discussion please.
Yes. This simply deletes Section 9. Section 9 is the provision that at the present time prohibits, and it's at the bottom of page 4 and the top of page 5. It deals with a person distributing indecent material to minors that the person knows depicts the conduct, and says and the person acts recklessly regarding the age of the child. This issue is currently in the courts being litigated, and as I understand it, the Federal District Court has struck down the current law as unconstitutional, and I believe that there's discussion on whether that's going to be appealed to the Ninth Circuit. No, if we could have Ms. Carpinetti come up on the
Sure.
Law.
The word quash came up again. Is it applicable outside of the word subpoena?
Yes.
It is. Okay.
I think I've used it before.
It's a vegetable.
Thank you. Section 9 of the bill is, well, first of all, the district court has not found this distribution of indecent materials to minors to be unconstitutional. The judge has issued an injunction against enforcing the provisions that were actually adopted last session of the bill. But and currently the posture of that litigation is the state has submitted a motion to the federal district court asking that the case be removed to state court. And there are also two motions before him, I believe, from either side asking for summary judgment. So that's where we are in that lawsuit. Section 9, we put Section 9 in the bill to make some clarifications to the culpable mental states of that crime, distribution of indecent materials to minors, which the other side of the litigation thought was helpful. And actually, we think it's helpful to, in this particular case, to spell out the applicable culpable mental states for these various provisions, because it's a little bit of a complicated statute. But it the rest of the entire application of that statute is under judicial review, and Representative Grunberg is perfectly correct.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to overrule. This is in litigation, and I think it was the feeling of the folks who were initially involved, possibly in the Department of Law, that putting this in might help resolve that litigation. During the course of the subcommittee hearing with both sides, the Department of Law was there and the other folks were on the telephone, it became clear that this would not settle the litigation. The litigation will have to proceed, and frankly, it's a constitutional issue. You can't stipulate whether something's constitutional or not. So everybody agreed that the simplest thing here is simply to delete Section 9, because it doesn't have any, it wouldn't have the intended effect on the litigation. Very complicated. So the amendment just effectuates what the subcommittee recommends, which is that we simplify this and just delete Section 9.
This is a little confusing to me. Is this amendment number 6?
Yeah.
And it doesn't say delete Section 9.
It does, Mr. Chair. The first is a title amendment. Delete that portion of the title.
Right.
And then page 4, line 22, through page 5, line 10, that's Section 9, and that's what we delete. Right. And everything else is just renumbering accordingly.
Okay.
It's very simple. It's really complicated
Is
otherwise.
That protocol just to say delete Section 9? Rather than
no.
Page 4, line 22, through.
I mean, you can do it if you're doing it homegrown, but this is the, Doug Gardner drafted the amendment. This is the way the drafting manual has it.
So everybody agreed?
On the subcommittee, yeah.
Andy Caprinetti, your thoughts?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunberg, I think it would be better to keep Section 9 in, but I don't think it's worthwhile holding up the bill. You know, the ACLU, who is litigating with us, agreed that these were changes that made the statute better. It doesn't fix everything. You're absolutely right. The litigation will proceed, our position is that it doesn't hurt, and it clarifies the law in a way that's a good idea. But it certainly is not a major issue with us, and we'd leave it up to the committee's discretion.
Well, help me out. It's helpful to delete it or helpful not to delete it?
When I said helpful, I think it's helpful to the state of the law to leave the amendment in with the changes, even though they don't arise to enough of a compromise that would satisfy the litigants in that lawsuit.
So for easiness, you agree with amendment number 6?
Yeah, I think it's fine.
All right.
Yes.
So we have amendment number 6 in front of us. Is there an objection? Anybody had an objection that's withdrawn? Any new objections? Seeing and hearing none, amendment number 6 is adopted.
which has been in this committee now for a month. Not a month, close enough. But there was some time off in between. So we have in front of us House Bill 127 amended version, I think it's M?
M.
Version M? Any other testimony for version M? Anyone in the audience want to speak to version M? Anyone? I'll reopen public testimony if there's someone out there wants to address version M as amended. Seeing and hearing none, then we're back where the testimony is closed. Vice Chair Thompson.
Chairman Gatto, I move that CS House Bill 127, Judiciary Version M, as amended with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations be approved.
Is there an objection? Seeing and hearing none, well, we've done it, guys. House Bill 127 is out of our hands, and I'll take a brief at ease while we actually sign the bill. Help us wade through that.
On the record, my name's Jerry Luckupt, Assistant Advisor of Statutes for the Alaska Legislature. Chairman Gatto, I don't see that there's a need for a court rule change here. I've examined Rule 79 and
82.
This provision, I wrote an opinion that I don't see that there is any change to a court rule occurring by the bill.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As the person who raised the issue, I'm satisfied with what Mr. Luckup says. I have no further problem with the bill.
Good. So that was really the remaining issue. And with that disposed of, don't leave. Who knows? We may have a conflict. With that disposed of, then all we need then is a motion to move HB 76, version A. Representative Thompson.
Chairman Gatto, I move House Bill 76, version A, with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Is there an objection? Seeing and hearing none. The third bill of the day, HB 76, is moved from committee. That, my friends, is a day's work.
Yeah,
and we're going to give you the remainder of the day off. Judiciary Committee, not yet.
Just to report on 150. We had over a two-hour meeting yesterday. We have a handful of issues remaining. I hope that we'll have to meet no more than once, and by next week at some time, we have to set the meeting. It hasn't been set.
We'll come before.
Then we'll be able to come to the committee and dispose of that bill.
And that is elder abuse, and for the records, okay?
They've abused me long enough.
Yes.
Wait till Friday.
Yeah.
Okay. With that, House Judiciary is adjourned.